It's Friday, June 11th. Ah, just the seven of us. We start here. President Biden prepares for his first sit-down with a group of seven.
What are you actually going to say and what are you actually going to do to Russia?
The U.S. wants a reset, but is that enough for the other members of the club? No, it's not just you. Prices are rising quickly.
If you tried to order furniture online, you're probably going to be waiting for a couple of months.
Inflation is nothing new, but economists are asking if it is here to stay. And so you're vaccinated. Can you take off your mask at work or not?
National regulators are definitely late to the party.
Lack of rules from the government doesn't mean there are no rules. It just means your boss makes them. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Until a few years ago, we were always hearing about this thing called the Group of Eight, right? The biggest economies in the world, the U.S., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, the U.K., and Russia. Well, 7 years ago, Russia was kicked out of the club for invading Crimea. The Group of Eight is now called the Group of Seven.
At every point along the way, we're going to make it clear that the United States is back and democracies of the world are standing together to tackle the toughest challenges.
And without Russia, it now calls itself a gathering of the world's richest democracies. Well, starting today, President Biden and these other leaders will gather on the shores of southern England and Cornwall. They all feel like they're on the same team. But smiles and handshakes only go so far. Can they actually still agree on what the world economy is supposed to look like to them? And what are these other six world leaders going to want from a Biden administration? ABC senior foreign correspondent Ian Pannell leads us off to start a big weekend for international relations. And Ian, no more Zoom rooms. What are you expecting from this gathering from these other leaders' perspectives?
Yeah, listen, I think the bar is set incredibly low, mainly because Joe Biden is not Donald Trump.
En particulier, nos partenaires américains qui jouent un rôle essentiel depuis le début, et je veux ici les en remercier.
I mean, we've already seen a comment from President Macron of France referring to the relationship with Joe Biden as it'll be nice to deal with a, quote, lucid personality.
Wow. I told the Prime Minister we have something in common. We both married way above our station.
You've seen Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, saying that meeting Joe Biden was a, quote, breath of fresh air.
I'm not going to disagree with the President that, or indeed on anything else. I think highly likely.
I think on a policy level, again, the bar is set pretty low. Just the physical re-engagement with the G7, with NATO, with the Paris Climate Accord, with the World Health Organization, with all of these organizations, I think there is a collective sigh of relief from the other G7 countries.
Hey, but that makes me wonder then, like during the Trump administration, if you confronted the U.S., you said, we need this, you didn't know what was going to happen, right? So does that mean, though, that now you got President Biden, this guy that these world leaders probably get along with more personally, but does that mean that they're, like, feeling free to extract concessions, give them a laundry list of demands that they've been saving up for 4 years? Like, what things are on the table that they've kind of been wanting to talk about with a different president now?
I mean, I think what you've got here is a U.S. president who's come to the table already fulfilling a lot of the things that other G7 leaders wanted. Re-engagement in international institutions, a restatement of the value of democratic states, a commitment to combating health crises around the world. In some senses, leading the fold, showing the way.
In my direction, the United States will purchase an additional 500 million doses from Pfizer.
We saw Joe Biden promise 500 million doses of the COVID vaccine.
100 low and lower middle income countries. They will be the beneficiaries.
Then we saw the UK government, Boris Johnson, pledge 100 million doses. But of course, it's not all sun and roses. There are severe points of disagreement.
Those giants, the winners of the crisis, are not paying a fair amount of taxes in Europe.
In terms of taxation, for example, on high-tech companies, in terms of trade.
Well, more than a year of travel restrictions have taken their toll on Paris, Europe's most visited city. The capital and its surrounding region have lost over 15 billion euros as tourism dried up.
President Biden has made clear that Nord Stream 2 is a bad deal.
On the things that kind of matter to economies.
It exposes Ukraine and Central Europe to Russia and Russian manipulation.
It's also about the U.S. looking for commitments from its European allies in terms of confronting Russia and China in particular.
Well, yeah, like, even as I was saying, even the new grouping of the G7 has this kind of us versus the others kind of a vibe. So are they on the same page with what that's supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly America has, for a while, wanted much more commitment, much more solidarity from the other G7 countries in terms of standing up to China and Russia.
Huawei, the world's leading manufacturer of 5G network gear. A U.S. campaign seeks to have allies around the world dump the supplier for security reasons.
And I think what's happened over the last 4 years is an awakening, if you like.
The best way to secure our networks is for operators to stop using new affected Huawei equipment.
Not just to the, you know, claims of ethnic cleansing and genocide against a Uyghur minority inside China, but also its expansionism. And I think there is a collective sense that people now view China through the same lens.
Well, and he's meeting with all these countries, and yet it almost seems like Vladimir Putin in Russia is already kind of making some chess moves in advance of their big one-on-one next week.
Yeah, we've now seen the effective banning of serious opposition political parties here. Alexei Navalny.
President Putin cracked down on the network of the dissident Alexei Navalny, who's been poisoned and imprisoned. How will President Biden confront President Putin? And what's the definition of success for this summit?
Well, first, George, we're meeting.
We didn't hear anything from Joe Biden when he spoke yesterday about that. I think there'll be a lot of pressure on those, on the G7 leaders, but especially on Joe Biden. What are you actually going to say and what are you actually going to do to Russia?
We will see. We're not expecting to have a huge outcome from this, but what we want to do is get back on a path, George, to a more stable and predictable relationship, which is in the interest of the United States.
So I think there'll be a general sense that people are going to welcome the statements that we've heard and what people are expecting over the coming days. But the proof of the pudding is going to be in the eating here. What is this policy actually going to look like? But on the whole, I think a collective sigh of relief.
All right. The gathering happening today. Certainly the yearbook photo will look different, but we'll see what kind of substantive issues come up as well. Ian Pannell there on the streets of London. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, you know, a dollar really doesn't get you what it used to a few weeks ago. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yesterday, we learned that once again, new unemployment claims continue to decline.
There were 376,000 first-time claims for unemployment benefits, a new pandemic low.
Which is good news. It's still higher than usual, still more volatile, but this no longer resembles something from an economics horror movie. In fact, these numbers look similar to the years following the Great Recession. But you know what also happened in the aftermath of the recession? Prices for everything seemed to go up quickly. And yesterday, amid a record day on the stock market, the U.S. government said inflation is now up to its highest rates since 2008. ABC's Elizabeth Jolsey covers the economy and the Federal Reserve. Elizabeth, how much higher are prices? Like, how high are we talking about?
They are high, Brad. We saw in the government CPI report prices rise 5% in May compared to a year ago. That's the biggest increase in nearly 13 years, as you mentioned, since August 2008. And we're seeing prices go up across the board here.
When you think about it, we shouldn't be all that surprised. I mean, the economy has basically gone from zero to 60 seemingly overnight as more people get vaccinated and economies begin to open up more.
We're seeing prices of airfares go up, of hotels go up, food, apparel. Across a range of categories, the reality is that Americans are paying more for goods and for services. And really, this gets to a couple of big trends going on in the economy right now.
I was going to say, sure, prices go up, but like wages have gone up, right? And those kind of follow each other, right? How big of a deal is it?
Yeah, generally we do see when wages go up, there is oftentimes costs passed down to the consumer. This is the case in an industry like groceries, for example. I was talking to a local grocer here in Washington who says that because labor costs have gone up in agriculture and industries that are getting these food out to people, the price of food is going up. And a lot of that ends up getting passed down to consumers.
Major companies, including Coca-Cola, General Mills, Hormel, Chipotle, have either all raised prices already already, or they're promising to raise prices.
I mean, in this report, you can see a huge range of categories where food went up. Whole milk prices, kind of random, up 3% just in the last month.
Our dairy farmer has 900 cows, and he has to fill his tractor with gas every morning. Well, if diesel was $1.50, it's now $3, so he's feeling the pinch.
Uncooked beef roasts, those are up 6.4% in the last month. So a lot of this is because we're seeing these costs passed down, but there are a couple of other key factors at play here when it comes to prices, and one of them is the supply shortage, these bottlenecks that we're continuing to see in the economy thanks to the pandemic.
Now everybody is kind of revved up, you know, wanting to spend money, go on trips, eat out. And so it's just causing this ripple effect within the economy.
Really, the key example of this in the CPI report is used car prices. They're just continuing to see these soaring prices for used cars and trucks. But that's because there's a shortage of new cars out there. We've had this global chip shortage throughout the pandemic. That slowed down the production of new vehicles. And as a result, used car prices are going up. In fact, that's even causing the prices of rental cars to go up. So there really are these trickle down effects.
There's also a shortage of taxi, Uber, and Lyft drivers to get you there. And that means a big spike in prices, up to 40% higher nationwide for car share services in recent weeks.
Furniture is another great example. We've seen soaring furniture costs, and there's huge backlogs. If you tried to order furniture online, you're probably going to be waiting for a couple of months. You know, lumber, appliances, all of these kind of products that have really seen huge spikes in demand over the past year. The supply chain just hasn't been able to keep up, and the result has been higher prices.
But so what, looking forward then, what do you do about it? How do you prevent it? And like, is there anything you can even do about it? You just wait for the prices to go back down?
Yeah, you know, Brad, well, there's no doubt we're seeing this inflation. The question really, and the debate raging in economics and here in Washington, is if these higher prices are here to stay.
Our economic team watches this incredibly closely, including our Secretary of Treasury, who has an expansive background in watching inflation.
So the general belief among economists right now is that these prices are going to adjust as the economy reopens, as things get back to normal. You only need to buy so many used cars, so many washing machines, and eventually the supply chain is going to even out. Demand is going to settle down.
When I took office, one of my greatest concerns was a K-shaped recovery from the pandemic, a recovery where high-income households rebounded quickly or even emerged better off, while low- and middle-income families suffered for a very long time. We can be confident now that's not going to happen.
The general expectation from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen or Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell is that this inflation spike is short term. But there is a big question mark here around what's called inflation expectations.
Here's the thing, we're seeing this huge increase, almost 30%, but consumers are willing to pay those prices for the used cars right now.
Basically, if people start to expect prices are going to keep going up, they might go out now and try to spend quickly before more price hikes kick in. And that could actually spiral into more inflation. The reality is that we have not ever been in a situation like this where the economy has opened up so fast, where we've seen these bottlenecks, where consumers have lots of cash on hand that they want to spend because of stimulus programs. So this debate about inflation is going to continue to rage on.
Yeah, I was going to say, Republicans will tell you that's why you don't want to spend an extra $1 trillion when you don't have to. But even Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, is saying, no, you do want to spend that money because you want people to have sort of a healthy economic life so that they can keep contributing to the economy. Elizabeth Schulze, really clarifying. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And speaking of how quickly this economy is rebounding, the most populous state in the country has its eyes set on next week for what it's calling its grand reopening.
On June 15th, we will be moving beyond the blueprint and we'll be getting rid of the colored tiers.
On June 15th, most California capacity limits and social distancing rules will be relaxed.
We can start to open up as business as usual.
That's on the state level. Businesses can still impose whatever limits they want. So a question from a lot of workers has been, do we still have to keep wearing these masks if we're vaccinated? Now, you might have heard of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. They tell your employer that you got to make sure your factory floor is safe, or you have to make sure people aren't inhaling asbestos, etc. They're in charge of workers' rights. California has its own version of this group. It's called Cal-OSHA. And recently, these regulators were saying, yeah, if you've been vaccinated, we're not going to make it illegal for you to take off your mask at work. That would be silly. Well, then they got pushback.
The pandemic is not over. And so I think we're going to be taking away some of the guardrails.
They adopted a new rule saying, okay, workers can take their masks off at work, but only if every single person in that room has been vaccinated as well.
Some business owners fear disaster.
I'm really concerned that we have a regulation that will pit workers against each other.
Well, this week, Cal-OSHA reversed itself again, saying when the big reopening arrives next week, vaccinated workers can, in fact, go maskless.
You asked if anybody was confused. I'll raise my hand.
And it all underscores, in some ways, how life at work has actually become more confusing at this stage of the pandemic. And until this week, worker protection advocates were still waiting on updated rules from the Biden administration. Jordan Barab is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary for OSHA. Those are the national regulators. And Mr. Barab, it's been a year and a half since this pandemic began. Workers are still kind of asking, what should we be doing? What are the biggest points of concern to you?
That's a good question. Workers across the country and in various different occupations have been asking themselves for the last year and a half how best they can protect themselves. And it's been a problem because although CDC issues guidance and most of that guidance is fairly decent, it is, in fact, only voluntary guidance. And it really is, therefore, up to the employer, what the employer wants to require or what the employer wants to allow his or her workers to do to protect themselves.
Even for employees, employees are coming in, some that have been vaccinated, and they're, you know, hey, here's my card. The CDC is now saying it, you know, and then we have to somehow be either the good or bad police and say, listen, there hasn't been any communication that has come directly for the guidelines for the restaurants. So we are sticking to the old rules and regulations that they had.
So it's really been a problem for workers because the guidelines that workers need to follow to protect themselves may differ not only from state to state, but from county to county or from employer to employer. It's been kind of chaos.
You can see Amazon employees walking in high traffic areas past monitors with mounted cameras. Those green circles on the monitor mean you're socially distant.
There are things like how far away do workers really need to be? Generally, the 6 foot mark is considered to be the standard for how far workers need to be separated from either customers or other workers. The problem is that depends on how COVID really is transmitted.
This scenario in China, 9 people in the direct path of an air conditioner's blower became infected, but those out of its airstream did not.
So then the question is, you know, what kind of respiratory protection do people need? I mean, are cloth masks good enough? Again, there hasn't been really good guidance to kind of differentiate in most workplaces between those who need just a cloth mask or those who may need more sophisticated respiratory protection.
But that's the thing, right? The CDC has really been trying to stress, if you're vaccinated, a lot of these concerns are greatly mitigated. They're almost moot. Well, guess what? Half of America is at least partially vaccinated. I'm sure they've already decided to start doing what feels safe to them. I'm sure bosses have been deciding what policies they need to implement for weeks, maybe months. So for OSHA to institute new rules, like punishable rules for employers, are they kind of late to the party here?
Well, national regulators are definitely late to the party. Let me just give you an example. Bobby Scott, who is the chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee, sent a letter to federal OSHA in January 2020, when there were only 6 cases of COVID in the entire United States. And that letter said, listen, OSHA, we got a problem coming here, especially for healthcare workers. You need to figure out, you know, what you're going to do about it and get ready to issue an emergency temporary standard. And throughout the rest of the Trump administration, nothing happened on the federal level.
As we've indicated earlier, we're going to be signing a number of executive orders over the next several days to week.
When President Biden, on the second day of the Biden administration, President Biden issued an executive order calling on OSHA to determine whether or not an emergency temporary standard was needed for all workers, not just healthcare workers, but all workers, and right. Make that determination. And if they made that determination, to issue an emergency standard by March 15th.
OSHA has determined that the most impactful action we can take at this time is to issue an emergency temporary standard that is focused on healthcare settings where workers are most likely to come into contact with someone carrying the virus.
Well, here we are in mid-June, and OSHA has just now issued a standard that only covers healthcare workers, really leaving all the rest of the at-risk workers in our economy behind.
She worked at McDonald's for 18 years.
It was her job at McDonald's that allowed Sonia to provide for her family. Jennifer says Sonia at the time wasn't given gloves or a face mask at work.
There are many, many other occupations where workers are also at high risk.
In April and May alone, about 16,000 meatpacking workers were infected with the virus. Nearly 90% of them were racial and ethnic minorities.
Meatpacking workers, poultry workers who work really within inches of each other.
They had these hair nets that we had.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I don't think those were really effective.
They were giving you hair nets to wear on your mouth?
Yeah, hair nets that...
The outbreak behind bars, critics say, further complicated by unsanitary conditions.
You have corrections officers, corrections employees who are working in close contact.
Social distancing in prisons and jails is often impossible.
The aisle is too small. It is way, way too small.
To hear that, and I know you were with OSHA during the Obama administration, so but this is not just a Trump thing, right? Because the Biden administration has had 6 months. There's still no rules for the non-healthcare folks. So, I mean, can they institute new rules now, or had they fully missed the boat for some of these concerned workers?
Yeah, well, I'm not clear as to the actual decision process that OSHA went through where it decided to only issue a standard for healthcare workers. And I really think, you know, what's happened here is that there's a whole wave coming out of especially the Biden administration, which is understandable. Really a major push on vaccinations. You know, we're moving forward, making progress. I think, an OSHA regulation was kind of seen as a skunk at the garden party. Here we are, allegedly coming out of this. And here we have this government agency issuing a regulation that's going to suddenly impose all these requirements at the same time that we're supposedly vaccinating our way out of it.
I believe that our estimates are that there are approximately 10.3 million employees or workers in the establishments that will need to comply with the requirements of the standard.
OSHA is a extremely small agency and very understaffed. If it were to investigate every workplace in the country just once, it would take them over 160 years. You're not quite as likely to get an OSHA inspection as you are to get a speeding ticket if you're driving 60 miles an hour around town. But nevertheless, it is the law of the land, and workers have a right to a safe workplace, and employers have an obligation to maintain a safe workplace. And that means a workplace even safe from COVID-19.
Yeah, and it's easy to think, like, COVID's behind us. Like, we've vaccinated our way out of this. If half the country has gotten at least one shot, that also means half the country has not gotten a single shot of a vaccine yet. And a big chunk of those vaccinated people are not in the workforce. We're talking about seniors, teenagers. That means that in the workplace, among working-age people, 18 to 65, at least one out of two workers still has not gotten a COVID shot. Jordan Barab, formerly of OSHA, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break, which means you have a few seconds to decide for yourself. How many oceans are there? One last thing is next. And one last thing. All right, how many oceans are there in the world? You might be thinking seven, not quite. That's seven seas. The Mediterranean is not an ocean. Traditionally, governments have recognized four oceans: the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, and the Arctic. But our partners at National Geographic chose this week on World Oceans Day to announce that for the first time since they began publishing maps in 1915, they will now officially recognize a fifth major ocean, the Southern Ocean.
Acknowledging this fifth ocean is a big deal for ocean science, conservation, and education.
This is the area on the globe that surrounds Antarctica. You might have thought, well, there's no borders between the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Indian, right? Don't they just go all the way down to the South Pole? Well, for decades, scientists have seen it differently.
The ocean here regulates the global climate. And the Antarctic Peninsula supports one of the largest food webs on Earth.
You see, unlike other oceans, which are kind of defined by the continents around them, the Southern Ocean is defined by a current. Working from west to east, water spins around Antarctica, moving cold water into warmer areas, warm water into the cold areas, around what is called the global conveyor belt, of which the Southern Ocean does the heaviest lifting. It's got its own type of water. It's colder, it's less salty than the others. It's got its own species that live there and nowhere else on Earth. So scientists and ecologists have long said this is a no-brainer. But as for borders, the current stops churning up at the 60th parallel. So from now on, once seafarers cross that latitude, they will be officially crossing the southern. From OSHA to oceans, right? The current has been going for like 34 million years, too. So finally, get some respect. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Ariel Chester, Lewis Millman, Tara Gimbel, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Sabina Gebermedin, Josh Hoyos, Trevor Hastings, Madeline Wood, John Parkinson, Becky Perlow, Matthew Van, and some huge assists from Stephanie Ebbs. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.